All right, both sides ready to proceed? Yes, and between appellants and amici, how have you all decided to divide up your time?
I think if my arithmetic works, I have 2 minutes of uninterrupted. I'll go for 10 minutes and attempt to sit down, divide my argument by 5 minutes for Mr. Field of the Institute for Justice, and then preserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, very good. All right.
40-minute argument.
Yeah, okay. If my math is right on his math, then that's 20 minutes that they've divided it up as. Okay, Mr. Fortin, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. On September 11th, 2023, Henderson Police Department came to the Spencer home, found Ms. Spencer's cash on her nightstand, purportedly found contraband in another room, and then concocted a drug trafficking theory so they could profit off of Ms. Spencer's cash. The city then violated due process when it neither named nor served Ms. Spencer as a claimant. After Ms. Spencer intervened and challenged the facial validity of Nevada civil forfeiture laws, the city then engaged in months-long procedural games. On the day before the city's opposition was due, the city gave the money back, proclaimed the proceedings over, and continued to call the Spencers criminals. For several reasons, reversal and remand is appropriate. First, neither Nevada civil forfeiture laws nor Rule 13 expressly bars counterclaims in a statutory forfeiture proceeding. But even if this court adopted the 68,000 case and barred in personam counterclaims, there is no dispute that Ms. Spencer's claim and delivery in rem counterclaim is proper, and she preserved her right to special damages. The court should therefore proceed to resolve the extent of the city's wrongful conduct. Nevada's civil forfeiture laws are screaming out for a judicial course correction. While there is much to discuss on this subject, Judge Thapar's concurrence in Ingram sums up why a post-seizure but pre-trial hearing is needed. Imagine you could take a car from a dealer's lot without paying, keep it for months, and make the car dealer pay you to give it back. Sounds like a pretty good deal. But now imagine that within 48 hours of taking the car, you'd have to explain yourself to a judge and give it back if you didn't have a good reason. The Spencers asked this court to end the state's joyride with Nevadans' property and confirm the Due Process Clause still protects property rights in Nevada. I welcome the court's questions.
I've got a question. Why wasn't there a motion to intervene for her?
Your Honor, under NRS 179-1158 as well as 1169, claimants are allowed to file an answer and a counterclaim. The city never objected to Ms. Spencer. They've never said that she isn't a claimant, and they gave her the property back, which dispositively shows that she was a proper party in the proceeding. We simply filed an answer and a counterclaim and proceeded as such. And I think that that's very important because the rules of civil procedure apply, and Rule 13 states that a party can counterclaim any claim they have. And that should end the court's analysis as to whether or not the counterclaims are proper. If the court looks at 1171 subsection 2, there's only a 60-day bar on claim and delivery actions, which our position is that 60-day bar violates procedural due process. The court looks at subsection 5. It says that the plaintiff shall serve the summons and the complaint on the claimant. If the court looks at subsection 6, an answer must be filed by the claimant. Interrogatory responses must also be responded to if made. 1169, as I just said, allows a party to raise an innocent owner defense. As the Fifth Circuit wrote, a claimant can do all of the things that a normal litigant can do when they intervene under Rule 24. It simply cannot be that just because we call it an in rem proceeding, that an individual that has come into the proceeding properly can't make counterclaims within the same fact, transactions, and occurrence.
Hey, counsel, why didn't she just take advantage of the statutory remedies under NRS 179.085, and does that impact the validity of your facial challenge to the constitutionality of the forfeiture statute?
So 179.085 is only operative when there is actually a criminal charge that has been made. None of the criminal charges related to the property and related to the drug trafficking theory were made until after the civil forfeiture proceeding ended. The property was simply with the city of Henderson when the forfeiture proceeding began. The only thing, the only court in the state of Nevada that could resolve that question was the district court under the prior exclusive jurisdiction doctrine, such that Ms. Spencer, 20 days later, filed her answer and counterclaims, and we proceeded with our motion to dismiss, which transformed into a motion for summary judgment. I think the city of Reno case highlights how this should proceed. The city
of where in 179.085 does it require a criminal charge?
So it says the jurisdiction of where the criminal proceeding has begun. And then if you look at
where?
And what about subparagraph 5 of, as long as we're piling on here, I'm sorry, 179.085 sub 5 says, if a motion pursuant to this section is filed when no criminal proceeding is pending, the motion must be treated as a civil complaint seeking equitable relief. So why, I was puzzled by your statement, as my colleagues were.
So subsection 1 says, may move the court having jurisdiction. As we read that, it is the court that actually has jurisdiction over the search and seizure warrant and the criminal proceeding, which is where it would be, which I believe was Henderson Justice Court. But I think the court should look at...
Warrants are done all of the time. They are typically done when there is no pending criminal charge.
Right.
So I'm just not following your logic.
So if the court looks at the In re Oakland Hills decision, the Court of Appeals looked at Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 41G. Motions to return property are predominantly, if not extensively, permitted only after the time period has elapsed for a forfeiture proceeding to begin. If you look at the legislative history in 1987, the legislators that enacted the civil forfeiture laws stated unequivocally that they saw motions for return of property and that they enacted the civil forfeiture laws for that purpose. So as we read the statutory scheme, 1156 and 1171 makes it so that for 120 days, the civil forfeiture proceeding should pend. Within 60 days, if the civil forfeiture proceeding has not begun, then a claim and delivery action can occur. And after that 120 days, the 179.085 motion can proceed. That's what happened in Mayola, in which this court said that even though there might be a criminal proceeding and a civil proceeding ongoing, that the individual could go before either one equitably and seek the return of their property. And so we think that the answer and counterclaim, along with the motion to dismiss, which was a motion for summary judgment, was proper. But what I want to turn this court to is, and I think the 179.085 problem highlights this, the burden shouldn't be on the property owner to say, I didn't do anything wrong. The due process clause provides a presumption of innocence.
So Mr. Fortin, I got to stop you because I'm confused procedurally about where we are in this case, because your client filed a 12C motion arguing that the case should be dismissed and the money should be released with interest to your client. The case was dismissed, the money was released with interest to your client, and you're complaining that that happened. So I'm really confused about why you're aggrieved by that.
We are complaining because my clients had their torts, they had several torts committed against them.
I understand the counterclaims. I'm not talking about the counterclaims right now. Is your client complaining about the dismissal of the forfeiture complaint?
We're complaining that as the district court found the matter moot, in three sentences said that 1171 provides that a complaint can be filed within 120 days, that 179.085 provides specific due process, and that my clients weren't harmed, which goes to the merits of their counterclaims. And therefore, we at least need this court to say that if the jurisdiction doesn't exist because the case is moot, that the court then can't proceed to the procedural due process wrongs. But we have brought special damages. We preserved them under 9G as this
court. So the complaint is only about the argument, the aggrieved status on appeal is because of the dismissal of the counterclaims, right?
Correct. And okay. We believe we have live claims.
You don't think their complaint for forfeiture should be reinstated, do you?
No, we do not.
Okay.
And we haven't asked for that relief. What we are saying is that the Nevada civil forfeiture laws are taking people's property, holding it for interminable amounts of times for years, and this case comes to this court in which the court needs to resolve the due process question that the district court already resolved. It also comes on the heels of Culley versus Marshall, in which the United States Supreme Court said that there is no need for post-seizure process. But there are two distinct facts that were present in Alabama's laws that are not present in Nevada's laws, and that is, one, you could post a bond following the seizure in order to get your car or your home back.
Sorry. So the counterclaims were dismissed, according to the court order, because the court held that counterclaims weren't proper in the context of an in rem civil forfeiture action. So, and the court didn't get into the analysis you're talking about now. So can you address how a counterclaim is permissible in the context of an in rem civil forfeiture action?
I'm happy to answer that question. I would just correct the factual record in that there are three sentences in the order denying the motion to reconsider that did reach the due process question.
Gotcha.
But under Rule 13, it states unequivocally that a party can bring any claim. It doesn't say any claim except in an in rem statutory forfeiture proceeding, which if the court looks at 16.1.
But Mr. Horton, so in this context, does that make sense? Because shouldn't this, and I appreciate that the statute says the claimants are parties, but they're not the defendant here, right? So wouldn't it make much more sense for any in personam claims to be filed as a separate lawsuit?
We think that they can be permissive claims, and you could bring other claims, but we think the in rem claim, the claim and delivery action, is a compulsory counterclaim. The only court that can decide who owns a piece of property in rem is the court that it is brought before.
Doesn't the claim and delivery counterclaim become moot when the property is returned?
Once we've preserved our right to special damages, and we believe that we are entitled to them. I see that I'm at my 8 minutes, and I'd like to preserve my balance for rebuttal. Mr. Field will take over from here.
Okay.
May it please the court, Benjamin Field for Amiki Stephen Lara and the Institute for Justice, joined at counsel table by my Nevada co-counsel, Jordan Smith. I'll start briefly on the question of whether counterclaims should be allowed.
I apologize. Can you spell your last name for me?
Field, F-I-E-L-D, like a football field or soccer field.
Oh, perfect. Thank you.
And we think that the most important thing on that procedural question is just to have a clear rule. Nevadans whose rights are violated in an unfair forfeiture proceeding shouldn't lose out on a remedy just because of a procedural trap. We agree with petition.
Well, how have they lost out on a remedy? Couldn't they just file a new case?
Yes, and my understanding is that the Spencers have done so protectively.
Okay.
But I think that highlights the issue, that it's going to be in the same court. It's a court of general jurisdiction, so I don't think it makes a lot of sense to just have two duplicative lawsuits about the same facts. And I think the Fifth Circuit's analysis in the $4,480,000 case that Mr. Forden was discussing is very persuasive. But whatever the rule is, we think it should be very clear how you bring these types of counterclaims.
Well, the Fifth Circuit case, though, they discuss it and they take issue with the other circuits that have held that you can't have counterclaims. But then they end up saying, well, sovereign immunity bars the claim. So it's a bit of a dictum discussion. I understand what the holding is, but when you try to apply it here, I guess what's troubling to me is I look at the statute, 179.1171, it has the reference to a claim and delivery action, but everybody agrees, I think, that claim and delivery is a species of in rem. So there are guardrails around that, and there's a 60-day provision, which I think is what Mr. Fortin is really concerned about, is that 60-day delay. But why should we put in damage actions that are in personam on top of that? And then you start, you have an intervener, which that's a separate question, but let's assume the intervention was appropriate and there was no issue with that. But pretty soon what's intended to be a summary proceeding becomes a full-on lawsuit that has all kinds of procedural complications and so on. It reminds me of our law on evictions, landlord-tenant, where there's a justice court summary eviction proceeding, and then there is separate proceedings to do with the damages and claims back and forth as to who did what to whom when. Why shouldn't that model apply here, since it's pretty much the overwhelming federal model?
I mean, I think that this forfeiture statute say the rules of civil procedure apply. Under Rule 13, there's a presumption that you can bring cross-claims, counterclaims, as long as you have jurisdiction to join the other parties. And so it seems somewhat inefficient to me to require two duplicative lawsuits over the same set of facts. But again, amici's position is just that this court should be very clear on how to bring these claims so that people don't lose their statute of limitations or things like that because of confusion. And I'd like to then turn the rest of my time to focus on the merits of the Article 1, Section 8 due process claim. And the core problem here is that civil forfeiture turns normal due process on its head. The general rule is that property owners have a right to a jury trial before the deprivation of property. But Nevada statutes allow the government to seize and hold property for 4 months without even initiating proceedings or giving owners any judicial process. Section 179.085 doesn't fix this problem. First of all, that's preempted by 179.1171's 60-day bar on any claim for delivery of property. That's how federal courts apply Rule 41G, the analog. Second, 179.085 also doesn't have any time limits. And I think then-Judge Sotomayor's analysis in Crimstock rejected very similar arguments that New York made by trying to point to other provisions. And she said, no, in the forfeiture proceeding itself, there needs to be protections to ensure that there's a prompt post-deprivation hearing that gives people some timely hearing. And also, 179.085 often won't be available. So it wasn't available to amicus Mr. Lara because the Highway Patrol gave his property to the federal government where there isn't 179.085 to protect him. And I also don't think it was available to Ms. Spencer because once the government initiated the forfeiture and was seeking stay after stay after stay, she was out of luck, and I don't think she would have been able to bring another claim. The last thing I just want to say...
What about the claim and delivery?
So she was able to bring a claim to delivery, but again, none of the Nevada statutes require the court to hear that on any timely basis. We're asking this court to adopt something more like what happened in Ingram and more in Crimstock, where you actually have a prompt hearing within 14 days or some prompt time, whereas nothing in the Nevada forfeiture statute or 179.085 require any timeliness. In this case, Ms. Spencer, who got her property back the moment the government had to go into court and defend itself, she was out of, you know, over $20,000 for 3 months. And that's a huge...
She got interest.
I mean, Your Honor, I think that if you look at the Ingram case and the Crimstock case, I think they very powerfully talk about how, suppose it was a car, like you'd be out of luck for months not being able to get to work or to childcare. And yes, in Mr. Lara's case, yes, he got his money back from the federal government, but he was stuck not being able to move near his daughters for 8 months because he wasn't able to buy a home in California while doing that. You know, interest doesn't solve the problem of being left without crucial property for months and months and months or even years. So we'd urge the court to reverse and remand.
Thank you. All right. Ms. Savage?
Good morning. Nancy Savage for the City of Henderson. May it please the court. I just want to touch on a few of the things that have been talked about here. This one as expeditiously as possible. As soon as the city learned of Ms. Spencer's interest in the property, efforts were made to return it. However, because litigation was already commenced by Ms. Spencer and she had the counterclaims, we weren't able to pay the money to her until we just sent it over. I mean, they wanted to settle for a much higher amount than we did. So that's what delayed here. She would have had it 30 days sooner. As far as 179.085, I believe under that statute that she could have gone into justice court the day after it was seized and gotten her money back. I mean, there's nothing that precludes her from seeking to get the property returned in the following, after it's been seized. And so, but what happened instead is she waited and waited. Obviously, she had the complaint in forfeiture because her husband was served with it. They were residing together. And she was the first one to file her answer and counterclaims. Anyway, I'm happy to entertain questions. It's probably a better use of my time.
All right, you're still in your first 2 minutes, so I was holding off.
That's fine. I saw you looking up.
So under NRS 179.1171, it provides that the property is subject to an action to claim its delivery only if the plaintiff does not file the complaint for forfeiture within 60 days after the property is seized. So
that's
my
correct.
Question is about your statement that she could have filed the next day seeking the return. This seems to say she had to wait 60 days.
I don't believe that it means that she has to wait 60 days. I mean, the way that I read 179.105, and I see more people looking at me, is that she can expedition. I mean, she can go into the justice court that issued the, you know, warrant pursuant to which they seized it well before the 60 days. I understand that she can't file her claim for claim and delivery until after the 60 days.
So what would she be going in asking for if not for claim and delivery?
That's a good question.
I thought so.
Because the way the statute uses the language is request the return for property.
So is NRS 179.085 like a completely separate procedure than the claim and delivery contemplated by 179.1171? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. I mean, but it's still also, it's not separate from the forfeiture proceedings. I know that, I believe in this case, maybe that's been argued as well, but it sets forth a more detailed and specific system to go in and.
So it's the city's position that the day after she could have gone in and filed her motion seeking the return of the property, yes, by something other than calling it claim and delivery, and didn't have to wait the 60 days.
Correct.
Interesting. Okay.
And just to build on that, so your reading of subparagraph 5 of 179.085, when it refers to a motion when no criminal proceeding is pending, it shall be treated as a civil complaint seeking equitable relief. That, in your mind, is not subject to the 60-day limit on claim and delivery that is articulated in 179.11711.
That's the way that I've interpreted justice.
Okay.
So why didn't your client name her as a claimant initially when the case was filed? It's found in the home that's jointly owned by the two of them, apparently in their bedroom, if I've read the materials correctly. How is she not someone potentially with a claim?
Well, I don't have a very good answer for that, Justice.
Okay, I appreciate that.
basically, because the focus was on the husband, and the husband was believed to be the owner of the garbage bag full of marijuana, and also that the money was tied to sales of the marijuana because of the way that it was stored and the way that it was positioned throughout the house, that it was believed.
Do you
that
agree
he
she
was.
Should have been named as a claimant?
I believe that it would have been helpful if she had been. I don't think she absolutely had to be named as a claimant. And I suspect, had we named her as a claimant, then we'd be, you know, being accusing her of the criminal actions that are involved. It's kind of a, but I mean, I think that it would be best to name everybody that potentially is there. I know that.
So
that,
is she at fault for not filing a motion to intervene when she's pretty obviously a potential claimant?
Well, she filed her answer first and her counterclaims first.
Right.
So I believe that she could have just as easily filed a motion to intervene at that point in time after she had counsel.
What challenge did you bring to the motion? I'm sorry, we're talking at the same time. Did you object when she filed the answer and counterclaims that she had not filed a motion to intervene? Did you challenge that by motion to district court?
No. I did not. We did not. Is there another question? Yeah. Sorry.
So given that the rules of civil procedure apply in this case by statute, they explicitly apply, we agree on that, right?
We do.
Okay. So then why doesn't Rule 13 allow a counterclaim?
Well, because it's an in personam claim, in rem jurisdiction, and the forfeiture process is directed towards deciding what happens with the seized funds. If there's somebody that's, such as Ms. Spencer, who's entitled to get the money back, then she should get it back. But the whole process is to just, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm troubled by your position on that because the statute that you're relying on for your forfeiture complaint expressly recognizes the availability of a claim and delivery action, if nothing else. And she asserted one in her counterclaim.
Correct.
And you got the case dismissed, but in her counterclaim for claim and delivery, assuming that one is recognized by the statute and therefore should have been allowed, she had a special damage claim in that counterclaim. And I don't know how that is mooted by your payment of the money and dismissal of the forfeiture complaint.
Well, and you're talking about the claim for delivery or claim and delivery claim?
Claim and delivery.
That's an equitable claim regardless, and so she doesn't get attorney's fees for the equitable claim.
That's a merits-based. You're saying she hasn't got a viable counterclaim for claim and delivery because the property's been returned and she doesn't get special damages? That's not a viable claim? Is that your position?
What my position is the language that you're referring to doesn't say counterclaim, it says treated as a counterclaim, so that doesn't open up all the other counterclaims that we've seen asserted here.
Right, but let me just take this piece. Sorry. Is claim and delivery an in rem jurisdiction claim?
Yes.
Okay, and as an in rem jurisdiction claim that is specifically referred to as something that can be in tandem with a complaint for forfeiture by a government entity, why should that claim be dismissed as a matter of law because it's styled a counterclaim?
I don't think it was dismissed as a matter of law. I think it was dismissed because the point of the claim and delivery claim was to obtain the return of property, and she obtained the return of property, and so that mooted everything that was in the in rem action.
What do you say to your friend across the aisle's argument that Sandy Valley, the decision, I understand it's got a red flag for other reasons, says that where there's a claim and delivery of withheld property that you can get special damages under Rule 9G of the Rules of Civil Procedure?
I don't believe under the in rem that they can.
Okay, so you think that is not allowed absent in personam jurisdiction? That's the end of the hunt?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay.
Just to be clear, they can bring a counterclaim as long as it's limited to being an in rem counterclaim.
Correct. I mean, the statute is written kind of strangely because they don't say it's a counterclaim, but they say treat it as one. So, yes.
Okay, so a claim and delivery counterclaim is permissible, but your argument is it was mooted.
Yes.
When the property was returned.
Correct.
But the other claims that are you know, seeking damages and other things based on alleged improper actions on the part of the city of Henderson, those are not permissible counterclaims.
Correct.
And, okay, so what in any rule or statute tells us that that's the right outcome?
Well, looking at NRS 179, it only allows for the counterclaim, as you've already referenced, for claim and delivery. It doesn't specifically state that it allows a counterclaim for anything else. We've cited basically kind of every case that we could find that dealt with can you bring a counterclaim in an in-rem, you know, forfeiture action. And across the board, every one of them has said, no, it's in personam, it should be brought separately. And I believe we're relying on that case.
So your position is they can file a separate case and pursue Absolutely. Those claims and deal with them as appropriate in that case?
Absolutely. Well, and I think, you know, some of the reasoning behind that is I think that the forfeiture action needs to be sorry about that.
Go ahead.
Trying to think and talk at the same time. Sorry. Anyway, because the forfeiture action is limited and focused, and the idea is to get to the point of decision on that as quickly as possible, and it's only focused on fee. Do they get it back? Do they get the property back? As far as all these other claims, whether they be tort claims or whatever else, that's a totally different type of cause of action, and I would think that would generally extend out quite a bit how long it takes to litigate the case.
Why, though, should, as a matter of policy, like if you take my property and it belonged to me, I didn't do anything wrong, and you sue to forfeit it, and I establish that, why should I, and I make a counterclaim for claim and delivery saying it's my property, I want it back, and I also want the cost that I had to pay attorney's fees, and I suffered these special damages as a result of you taking and holding my property, why should I have to bring a separate action in order to assert that claim? From the perspective of the claimant, it seems to me that's not efficient. That then is not letting them have full closure at the end of the case. I mean, what policy supports saying claim and delivery is permissible as a counterclaim, but it's limited to getting the property back, and if you want your attorney's fees or other special damages attributable to that, you have to go bring a separate lawsuit?
Again, I think that if you read the statutes together in 179, I don't think it provides for a claim for special damages under that in rem jurisdiction. I just don't think that it does. I mean, you see from time to time that possibly they, you know, if we'd agreed to keep that in, I guess we could have, but I don't think that they have a right to bring it in the in rem forfeiture action.
So part of what they're complaining about on appeal is also the denial of their request for attorney fees, which if the entire case is in fact complete and won't be brought back to life, then that would be something that we'd have to evaluate.
That's absolutely correct. And obviously we think you should affirm the lower court on that. But if you look at what the basis for their claim was, I mean, there wasn't anything vexatious. Nobody went in, and I know that they've acted like we went in to, you know, go after these people and steal their money, but there's nothing that establishes that, and certainly...
You have 5 minutes. Go ahead.
I got it. And certainly... if you look at it, I mean, basically, they're the ones that prolonged it. They brought multiple motions and motions for reconsideration. It wasn't the city that was prolonging it. We definitely gave her back the property as quickly as we were able to do.
Has the city tried to label Mrs. Spencer as a criminal?
Never.
Never?
No. Okay. No, we have not.
Okay.
I don't understand, you know, where that comes from. I think that from what I could tell of the things that opposing counsel has filed on this, that once she got the money back, her husband's drug case was proceeding with the district attorney's office, and that they said, well, now if it's your money, maybe it's your drugs, which I think is possibly a logical conclusion. But our office, our city, no, we did not.
I have, if this court were to say, okay, the action's moot, we're going to sustain the dismissal, we still would have to vacate the district court's judgment to the extent that it opined about the constitutional issues in the DEC relief. It ventured into DEC relief counterclaim territory when it made those statements in its order. Would you agree with me that those would need to be vacated were we to credit your position?
Yes, I had been thinking through how that complicated the procedure, but if you ruled that it's that she was right in mooting it, rule that, you know, affirm that counterclaims are not appropriate in the interim action, basically, yes. I mean, they would have to have the opportunity to pursue that, and I believe they are in their current separate civil suit.
Let me ask you a question, if I might, about the timing issue expressed by the appellants. And I understand the argument you're making under 179.085. Somebody gets arrested, it automatically generates a case in the justice court jurisdiction in which they're arrested, this case Henderson. So under that statute, arguably, you could go before the justice court and move for the suppression and return of illegally seized property, and if the court grants that, it must be returned. But what if there's not a charge filed?
Well, I'm glad you asked that.
When
the warrants are issued in justice court, they actually open a case with a case number for each warrant. And so there is a case, regardless of whether charges have yet been filed or not. Well, and they can go into justice court on that case to request the return.
When you're saying the justice court opens a case when a search warrant is signed off on by a judge? You're talking about an arrest warrant.
Yes.
Okay, so let's just say police go and get a search warrant, and they go and search a residence, and they don't immediately file charges, but they seize property. So that person has no criminal charge, no criminal court with a jurisdiction, so they're subject to waiting the 120 and or 60 days of 179-1171, yeah?
But even if it's a search warrant, it's still issued by that justice court. Sure, and they can go into that justice court.
But there's no case or criminal charge.
Correct. I don't think there has to be a case or criminal charge.
So you think issuance of the warrant confers jurisdiction on the court for purposes of 179.085?
Yes. That's my understanding, yes.
Even though there's no case number?
Yes. And I'm not getting the right 179 number, but the statute says, you know, that you don't have to have criminal charges. You don't have to prove that to go forward.
And so under the statute, you think it would be treated as a civil complaint seeking equitable relief under sub 5?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm running down here. So just to sum up my position, the city of Henderson believes that the lower court should be affirmed on each portion of the case. I understand that there's that one line left, and I think you're right. That probably would need to be vacated. But as far as the mootness order, as far as no counterclaims, and as far as the denial of sanctions in the form of attorney's fees, the lower court should be affirmed. Thank you.
Mr. Fortin.
Correct some facts as well as some law. The Fifth Circuit said that and pointed to the Federal Tort Claims Act, you actually can bring under the Federal Tort Claims Act claims against the federal government in a in rem forfeiture proceeding if you read the Fifth Circuit decision. But even if the court wants to narrowly apply the 68,000 case, look at footnote 7, and it specifically says, citing to the Eighth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit's decision, that a Replevy counterclaim is available. So even under their case law, we are allowed to bring a claim in delivery action. To correct the 085 problem, I think we need to look at the text of 1171, and it isn't just saying a claim in delivery. It says bars any action to claim its delivery for 60 days, which is what the 085 statute provides. If you go look at 31.840, except as provided in NRS 179.1171. You look at the legislative history, and the legislative history says you can't bring motions for return of property. That's what the whole point of why in 1987 the legislature created civil forfeitures. I think the court should remember that a prior hearing always imposes some costs in time, effort, and expense, and it is often efficient to dispense with the opportunity for such a hearing. But these rather ordinary costs cannot outweigh the constitutional right. Procedural due process is not intended to promote efficiency or accommodate all possible interests. It is intended to protect the particular interests of the person whose possessions are about to be taken. We ask this court to reverse and remand because the Spencers properly brought counterclaims, the city violated procedural due process, and the Spencers have been damaged, and because of those actions, they are entitled to their day in court. I thank the court's time.
Thank you. All right.